the Palestinian issue isn't really a priority for the rest of the Arab world anymore. That really we can push for normalization without resolving the Palestinian issue. And that basically we can just ignore what happens to the occupied Palestinian territories. Hamas on October 7 exploded the pending Saudi normalization deal, effectively exploded a bilateral security agreement that the United States was going to give to Saudi Arabia. It exploded whatever fantastic feelings of stability that Jake Sullivan and McGurk had, that we were in a quiet period. And it has expanded the Palestinian issue and the Palestinian conflict to at least five countries in the rest of the region, where, for example, the Houthis in Yemen have effectively joined the war effort and joined the Hamas resistance effort by saying they will stop ships bound to Israel. Really, a form of sanctions. The United States can't be the only country in the world to impose sanctions on other states unilaterally without UN Security Council authorization. I believe there are over 35 countries that the US sanctions, the vast majority without authorization. And so to see that war expand as it has, to see the United States' plans, the Israel's plans completely disrupted, to see the entire region on alert, to now saying, well, we really do need a two-state solution and we really do need a pathway and maybe we should have the PA come in and govern. But what are we going to do? All of a sudden, focused on the situation in Gaza and Palestine. I am beyond saddened. I am horrified. I am gutted that it took 25,000 Palestinian lives, over 10,000 children, to force the international community to deal with the situation in Gaza and stop trying to brush 2.5 million people under the rug, under the Israeli siege, the ongoing, continued without resolution. The Palestinian people said no. And now the whole world is focused on a new conversation. So, in the smallest of silver linings here, I would say the fact that there is now a reconsideration of what we need to do to end the occupation and apartheid, and could be potentially an important step forward. At least it opens up the possibility of that.
There are constant pronouncements that the Biden administration seeks no regional war. But Nasreen Malik in The Guardian says, I'm quoting, "The truth is that war is already here. It has now spilled into Lebanon, Yemen, Iran, the Red Sea, and the Arabian Sea," unquote.
I would add Iraq and Syria and Jordan to that list. As I mentioned, the recent attack, believably from Iraq or Syria, into the U.S. military base, killing three servicemen and injuring 30. But yes, you're absolutely right. A regional war is here. And in some way, unfortunately, this plays into the hands of the Boltons and the Mike Pences and others who are today, I believe, and even in CNN, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, who want to use October 7 not as an opportunity to resolve what needs to be resolved, which is Israeli apartheid and occupation, but to distract from that by opening a new front, a new war with Iran and all of the armed groups that it charges being associated with Iran, like Hezbollah, like the Houthis in Yemen. So kind of a grand anti-Shia, anti-Iran war to deal with the responses to October 7, as opposed to dealing with the problem that we should be dealing with post October 7, and that is the problem of Israeli occupation and apartheid. Those are the problems we have to solve for.
And speaking of apartheid, B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization, Amnesty International, and Human Rights Watch have all determined that Israel is practicing apartheid.
That's right. And the forced organization to reach that legal conclusion in the way of other human rights organizations was Al-Haq, a West Bank-based Palestinian organization that was subsequently designated as a terrorist organization by Israel. And its office is shuttered and its I believe its computers even confiscated. And in fact, the U.S. recently denied a visa to the executive director of Al-Haq, Shawan Jabarin, who's been to the U.S. on numerous occasions and, globally lauded human rights activists, just to see show you how in sync U.S. security tends to be with Israeli accusations.
The current Israeli government is routinely called the most right-wing in its history. Talk about what was happening in Israel before October 7th in terms of the massive protests and demonstrations challenging the government's plans to emasculate and eviscerate the independent judiciary, or relatively independent judiciary, that Israel had. I should say, no mention in these demonstrations was ever made about occupation and dispossession of the Palestinians. It was strictly focused on this issue of the judiciary.
So basically, as you were noting, Israel had its longest record of protests against the government, longest and biggest protests that really lasted for months against the Netanyahu and his allies' efforts to pass a new law that would basically subject Supreme Court decisions to parliamentary review and basically kneecap the independence of the judiciary effectively. I mean, there are a variety of reasons, some domestic, some having to do with Netanyahu's own prosecution underway for corruption and other crimes, but as well as little bleeps of findings from the Israeli Supreme Court that would limit their ability to the government's ability to demolish some housing, illegally confiscated housing in the West Bank, and so on. So these protests were all underway, and then October 7 happens, and of course, massive swing of unity towards the government in the immediate shock of October 7. And largely seeing a suspension of those protests about those domestic or understood to be domestic issues. The only protesters really emerging are hostage family protests demanding that the government's not doing enough to free the hostages, endangering the hostages, killing hostages, as we now know has occurred. But now, again, there is a resumption of some of the domestic protest in the country because the government has passed additional legislation to circumscribe society, to expand censorship, to punish Israelis who have questioned the government's military response in Gaza. But at the same time, you've seen a dramatic increase. Really shocking incursions by the Israeli military, not just the Israeli military, but the Israeli security forces that have police control over the territories, which under the new Israeli government was moved out of the IDF and into the hands of one of the most extremist ministers. We have seen the ministers giving out weapons to Israeli settlers, and accordingly, I think we need to update our terminology to call these armed settlers paramilitary groups. That's what they are. Between the rampages of these paramilitary groups, regular IDF incursions, it's definitely a major expansion of a very violent and militaristic approach. And, that's coupled with increasingly unapologetic, naked pronouncements that the Israeli government does not want a two-state solution. That's actually the truth, just the way Trump would occasionally utter some truths, however shocking and heinous, when talking about U.S. policy in the Middle East. This is just the Israeli government being a lot more transparent and naked of something that's been true all the time. They don't want a two-state solution. They do want to reoccupy Gaza. They do want to annex Area C in the West Bank. They do want to drive Palestinians out of Gaza, but also out of the West Bank and certain parts of the West Bank. So all of this is much more blatant and naked, and that's why you're seeing many American Jewish groups increasingly in a panic. Because this goes so far from any conception of an Israeli government that they could legitimately support. So the divisions in Israeli society, which I think were masked over by the war in Gaza over the past 3 months, are much worse in the American Jewish community. That is where we are seeing the greatest fissures, because from the statistics that we've seen, the vast majority of American Jews believe Israel is an apartheid state, want a ceasefire, oppose the Netanyahu government and all its extremist policies domestically and with respect to the territories, while the leadership of these Israeli organ of these pro-Israel organizations in the U.S. continue to unconditionally back, support, protect, and defend the Israeli government and seek to spend over $100 million to defeat Democratic candidates who've been critical of Israel. So this is translating very directly here on the ground into what is increasingly very elite-driven, undemocratic, unrepresentative, big money move. To go against what the majority of American Jews want, the majority of Democrats want. And so it's really a test of our own democracy.
Jewish Voice for Peace says, quote, "The unchecked military funding, diplomatic cover, and billions of dollars of private money flowing from the U.S. enables and empowers Israel's apartheid regime. Those who continue calling for ironclad U.S. support for the Israeli military are only paving the path to more violence," unquote.
It's a perfectly accurate statement, primarily focusing on what my organization focuses on, which is our government's actions and responsibilities. You know, we here in the U.S., we can't necessarily control what Israel does or doesn't do. And I'm not convinced that ending U.S. military aid to Israel will suddenly create reform or reformist views in these messianic, selfish, self-driven political leaders in Israel. But I do know that I don't want my government to be aiding and abetting the illegal occupation, apartheid, and plausibly genocidal actions in Gaza. I don't want my country to be legally liable for this. I don't want my country to have this moral stain on its own record. I don't want my taxpayer dollars to go to this regime. And all we're waiting for now is for our own elected officials to show some connection to, some responsiveness to what the majority of their own constituents want, which is an end to this blind, disastrous, harmful support for Israel.
You mentioned paramilitaries. These are euphemistically called settlers. Perhaps they should be called colonizers, and the houses that they're living in are colonies. That would give people here a better sense of what's actually going on in a settler colonial movement. You also use the term IDF, the Israeli Defense Force. Now, defense is a curious term as well. Historically, aggressors who attack say they're responding in self-defense. Hitler in 1939 said, "Poland is attacking us. We have to defend ourselves." Lyndon Johnson was saying the same thing about Vietnam, and Bush in Iraq, and so it goes on and on. The use of language to manipulate the discourse so people don't understand what's going on.
We obviously have seen an ongoing effort to fight the language of law, to fight, for example, the description of the occupied Palestinian territories as the occupied Palestinian stories, continued efforts to recharacterize them, but more importantly, force the media to mention them as so-called disputed territories. And I think that manipulation is clear. I don't know how much of a difference it makes in people's minds to use the term settler versus colonialist. I think the term colony probably is familiar to most Americans as the American colonies. I don't know how much history and understanding of colonization and decolonization the majority of Americans have at this moment in time. But I think Americans certainly understand the concept of apartheid and war crimes and genocide. You know, that is the record that the Biden administration is going to have to defend and is going to fail in defending. So the stakes of this continued support for Israel, the stakes of continuing to whitewash its crimes, Biden risks paying a very high price for this. And the Democratic Party risks paying a very high price for this because Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, progressive Americans are increasingly making clear every single day that they will not vote for Biden. And if people are afraid that Trump will win as a result, then that's something the Democratic Party should take into consideration. And maybe they should consider running a candidate who is not as divisive, who is not now as hated as whom people are calling Genocide Joe. So the stakes of how the U.S. responds in this moment of time cannot be higher. What the Biden administration has to decide is whether it will put the interests of the United States, including its own chances to win the election this year, ahead of the interests of the apartheid Israeli government. And if they can't even prioritize their secure election ahead of protecting apartheid Israel, then that, I think, really signals the depth of the problem we have, the extent to which our own elected officials undermine our own country's interests, their own individual interests, rather than allow the criticism of Israel, rather than hold Israel accountable.
It's interesting that Liberal Democrat Nancy Pelosi said that those who criticize Israel are Putin stooges, and she's called for an FBI investigation of those who criticize Israel.
How embarrassing, how despicable for Representative Pelosi to so disparage her own constituents as not just Russian, but also Chinese spies, rather than grapple with the reality that her unconditional support and protection and defense of Israel is opposed by her own constituents. She would rather take a Trumpian approach to calling for investigations, harassment effectively, accusing Americans as being traitors, which is punishable as a crime in the United States, rather than grapple with the reality that Americans don't support what Israel is doing. Americans don't support what the United States government is doing in support of Israel. And that, you know, is really, again, just a microcosm of what we see writ large in the Biden administration, as we were talking about ahead of the elections to come.
The Israeli prime minister told the BBC, "Don't accuse us of war crimes. We are the most moral army in the world." That's a direct quote. How have the actions in Gaza of Israeli military forces lived up to the prime minister's assertion? I'm thinking of reports, photos, videos, and testimonies of Palestinians who were detained by Israel, who were blindfolded, stripped to their underwear, and held in what the UN says are horrible conditions. The Times, to its credit, has reported on this, a front-page story.
You know, I don't really know how much of the world takes Netanyahu seriously. I would guess that the vast majority of those who follow the news in Israel-Palestine understand not only that Netanyahu has been a decades-long architect of Military incursions, war crimes, land theft, various violations of the Rome Statute, not just since October 7, but for decades. To hear him talk about a moral army in the world, I mean, it's just a meme now. I don't think anyone takes that seriously, honestly. Basically, if he wants to claim that a moral army of the world has now been found of committing plausibly genocidal actions, committing a plausible genocide in Gaza, then you can decide whose word you want to take for it, Bibi Netanyahu's or the International Criminal Court's.
You must know that term PEP, Progressive Except Palestine. Is that still holding water?
Oh, I mean, I think it definitely still holds water. And unfortunately, it has been a very rough period and rough test for American progressives or even moderates and liberals who otherwise love to champion the rights of Ukraine and Ukrainians against foreign invasion, occupation, and war crimes, who never run out of tears for people in Xinjiang subject to Chinese oppression, still want to talk about, and rightly so, the horrible dictatorship in Syria, just can't find a word to describe Israel's conduct. And it has become an impossibility in the face of what we're now seeing live on camera 24/7 since October 7 to maintain that, to justify that. And you've seen a lot of people, at least on social media, saying, I used to be a supporter of Israel. I can no longer maintain that as a progressive, as even a moderate. And I think that there has been a tremendous change in the discourse in the United States, so that it has become much more mainstream to criticize Israel's gross conduct in Gaza. So the good news is that that progressive against Palestine space is crumbling. The mainstream of Americans are shifting to support Palestinian rights, and that increasingly those who insist on defending Israeli crimes, Israeli abuses, are really extreme anomalies who I don't think really can qualify as progressives. I would say that some progressives are still trying to hide what they say, and I think that the civil society organizations that have spoken out on other atrocities, who've had very little or nothing to say on Palestine, they should be called out. They should be pushed because they're feeling the pressure.
There's some talk, particularly in Europe, of a two-state solution. Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies told me in no uncertain terms, there's no longer a possibility of a two-state solution, she said. There's not going to be a two-state solution because there's no land left for a viable, contiguous Palestinian state. What are your views on this issue?
My views are twofold. First of all, the two-state solution, as configured by the Oslo Accords, is dead. It was doomed and destined for deliberate failure, by Israel. The Israeli government has never been interested in a two-state solution and certainly is not interested in it now. And so I think to that end, as currently envisioned, a two-state solution along the lines of the 1967 armistice lines, that is the so-called Green Line, that's dead. It's over. It's not happening. And any yang-yang you hear bandied about now by the Biden administration of securing Saudi normalization in exchange for so-called pathways to a resolution of the conflict, pathways to Palestinian statehood, people should be on notice that that is a total hoax. They're empty words. The Israelis love to commit to pathways to nowhere that don't obligate them to do anything, that don't hold any kind of accountability mechanisms when the pathways remain stalled in perpetuity, just like Oslo. So please don't fall for it. It's nothing but a ruse. However, the process by which I do believe there can be a transition of Israel from its current status as an apartheid, occupying, genocidal state to a rights-respecting state is within reach. I think the way for us to get there is to have a transitional government, a caretaker government that will end apartheid and occupation and create the conditions on the ground that will allow the people from the river to the sea to democratically decide how they want to organize themselves, whether it's one state, two states, three states, whatever. The answer to that question can't come from an unelected bloc of Palestinians, aka the Palestinian Authority, negotiating, quote unquote, on behalf of Palestinians, any more than Netanyahu can legitimately speak as a representative of all Israeli Jews, given the divisions in his own society. The citizens, the people, should decide democratically how they want to organize their governance. The rights of the people have to come first. The decision on governance is theirs to make after.
Thanks very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
You were just listening to Sarah Lee Whitson on Gaza, international law, and the Biden presidency. I talked with her on February 1st. Sarah Lee Whitson is executive director of DAWN, Democracy for the Arab World Now. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Medea Benjamin, Max Blumenthal, and Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Sarah Lee Whitson on Gaza, international law, and the Biden presidency, and for the classic Noam Chomsky book, Propaganda and the Public Mind, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
This is Kelly from the Peak Publication Society, SFU student-led newspaper. Recently, news organizations have been facing issues sharing news content. All news outlets, including small publications like us, have been affected due to Meta's refusal to comply with the Online News Act and compensate news companies. We have been serving our diverse student community for years and need your support to continue. If you'd like to contribute as a paid writer, illustrator, or photographer, follow us on Instagram at thepeak@SFU. Keep reading our stories at the-peak.ca. If Meta is listening, we're just a community promoting SFU events. Please don't block us again.